WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Ridley, used to be a stand-up comic. Then he wrote for such sitcoms as The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Martin, and The John Larroquette Show. Now he's becoming known for his novels and movies. He wrote and directed the film Cold Around the Heart. He adapted his novel Stray Dogs into the screenplay for U-Turn, which was directed by Oliver Stone and starred Sean Penn. Like Stray Dogs, Ridley's new novel, Love is a Racket, is a humorous homage to film noir. It's about an ex-wannabe screenwriter who has resorted to making a living with small-time con games. As the novel opens, he's $15,000 in debt to a loan shark, and the loan shark is giving the kind of urgent reminder that loan sharks are famous for.
Crop was the sound that I heard. Heard it twice, crop, crop, one time each for my two fingers that got broke. I heard my bones pop before I felt anything. Gunshot loud, they echoed in my ears. Maybe that was tip-off that what had just happened was going to hurt like hell. Wrong. It hurt so bad, I didn't feel a thing. The hands that held me, Ty's hands, big like bear claws, strong like presses, let me go. I twisted to the ground, slow, the way a snowman melts. Couldn't help from going down. Something about having body parts mangled that messes with your lucidity. I gave that a lot of thought as I lay on the hard, dirty pavement that felt featherbed comfy to my screwed-up senses. If I slept a million years in this outdoor bedroom, I couldn't care less. Sorry, Jeffy, Ty said from somewhere above me. He meant it, too. I could hear it in his voice. It almost made me feel guilty. It almost made me feel like, even though he just busted my finger, somehow I was the bad guy. All Dumas had to add to things was, let's see if we can't get me my money. Do you know, Jeffy? I heard the two of them walk away. I heard them get in their bins and drive off. The sound seemed to drift from the other side of the planet. I was alone, on the ground, in an alley. I thought about getting up, but the growing throb in my swelling fingers told me otherwise. It said I should relax, take a rest, pass out for a while. Why not? I didn't have any plans, nowhere to go except a little further down in life than I already was, and there was plenty of time for that. I got cozy with the dirt and rubbish and remained undisturbed. People passed by the lip of the alley, but they paid me no mind. Just another black man stretched out near some garbage can. So what? So nothing. So life went on around me. I took my finger's advice and went to sleep. Later I came to. The same throbbing in my fingers that passed me out woke me up. Except sometime during my mini-coma, the dull pain had gone through a metamorphosis into full-on agony. Agony that instructed me in the strongest possible terms to get to a hospital. Hospital. That's what I thought. Free clinic is what I meant.
That's John Ridley reading from his new novel, Love is a Racket. The main character is a small-time con man who at once, who earlier in his life tried to be a screenwriter and gave up on that.
Yes.
Why did you want to make this con man a former would-be screenwriter?
Well, it's interesting. In the original drafts, he knew a lot about Hollywood and he had a lot of angst against Hollywood, but he wasn't a screenwriter. And it wasn't until I sat down and worked with my editor that he really started said to me, you know, there's something else going on here, and you really, to find this character, you sort of need to flush it out. And as I was going through the story again, I really realized that this is a guy who'd been roughed up by Hollywood. He was stuck there, and someone who had a really, really hard time and had an axe to grind. And, of course, someone who, myself, has sort of been through the Hollywood grind there, I started to realize that, in a way, this character was a lot more like me than I think I wanted to fess up in some of the early drafts. And that really is one of the great things about working with an editor and coming in, having someone come in with a fresh perspective and can help you find something that was in the story but wasn't really articulated as well as it could be.
What are some of the small-time cons that you've come up with for your character?
Well, this guy, he plays the short con, and the short con is usually just trying to cheat people out of their money, say, $5 or $10 at a time. You go into small mom-and-pop stores, and you try to do a fast con on them where you try to get change from them, but confused them to the point where you get $5 or $10 back. It's not a lot of money. And actually, my sister used to work at a dry cleaner's, and somebody ran that con on her once. And you get maybe $5 or $10. You can't really con people for a lot of money when you do the short con. So you have to work constantly. You have to work all day long to make $50 or maybe $100 at best. And it's sort of an interesting life because you're not making a lot of money, but you sort of live for the con because you would rather do that than do anything else. And there are times in the story where people call Jeff D on that and say, look, for all the work you're doing, why don't you go out and get a job where you can make some real money? But the guy's a con man at heart. You also have a, you know, we have card players, we have gamblers, and we have a lot of people are just sort of working at that low end of bringing any kind of money in. And to me, that's fascinating that people would rather be cons and card players than work for a living. To them, that's a better life, no matter that they might be getting their fingers broken.
Now, your characters live in, you know, the kind of low-rent part of Hollywood that you describe as stinking of desperation.
Yeah.
Have you lived in neighborhoods like that yourself?
I did. When I first came out here, I lived on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. And when I first came out here, it almost sounded cool. You live on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. But as life goes on, you realize it really is a desperate place, and it really is a place where people end up when nothing else works out for them. It's just people who want... You know, they want to be famous, or they want to be rich, or they want to just be artists, or they want a round of applause at the end of the day. But they want something, and they can't get it. It's a really awful place, especially when you realize that most people who don't really know Los Angeles or have never been out here, they talk about, yeah, I'd love to go, and I'd love to see Hollywood. Or you see the tourist buses pull up in front of the Chinese Theater. People take pictures, get on the bus, and get out of there as fast as they possibly can. To me, it's a very sad place. I think it's sad. And I have a line about this in the book because the weather is so nice. You know, you have beautiful sunshine and palm trees, but there are people who just want to make it through the end of the day. It's, to me, heartbreaking.
Now, you grew up in Wisconsin, then moved to New York, and then went to Los Angeles, hoping at first to be a stand-up comic.
Yes.
Yeah. What was your material like then?
It was, at that time when I first moved out here, it was moving into sort of, not really a political comedy, but it was more... social comedy. It was more comments about things that were going on. I had a joke right about that time about, it was right after, right about when President Clinton was pushing for gays to be allowed in the military. And I said, you know, a lot of people are upset about that. And my line was something like, well, I think, you know, gays shouldn't have to go to the military. I don't think gays, blacks, or women should have to serve. It's just be, you know, middle-class white guys whose parents make more than $100,000 a year. I have no problem with that if they want to go to foreign countries and get shot at. So it wasn't strictly political, but it was more sort of that, you know, sort of taking what society is thinking and try to find, you know, the flip to it. You know, if they don't want gays in the military, great. If they don't want blacks in the military, that's fine. Things like that. And it was sort of, it's interesting. I think when you're, my feeling was when you're sort of a young black guy and you're being very articulate and sharp about politics, you don't really get as much play as if you were sort of like the Def Comedy Jam comedian that people, you know, it's laugh and it's funny, but it's sort of not quite threatening because that's what you think a black guy should be talking about. There's certainly, you get to the point where people don't look at you and say, hey, we're going to build a sitcom around this guy. So that's pretty much when I started writing.
So you went on to write for television sitcoms.
I was writing for television. I was writing for The Martin Show and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and I wrote for The John Larroquette Show. And I'm actually writing again now in TV drama. I'm writing on a new drama that's going to be on this fall on NBC called Trinity. But when I was on The Fresh Prince is actually when I started writing Love is a Racket, and it was a very difficult show to write for. It was a very popular show, but at the same time, it was very narrow-focused in the type of writing you were doing. You know, it was usually, you know, a fat joke and a kind of a short joke and a dumb joke about the characters, and that was it. And it was very hard for me because at the one time, on the one hand, I was making a good deal of money, and I had respect in television, but I wasn't happy with what I was doing, and I used to lock myself in the office and start writing this novel, which was Love is a Racket. And at the time, I really thought it was probably never going to go anywhere. No one would ever see it. But it really made me feel good. I mean, it was my life preserver in a way.
Now, why did the noir style of storytelling appeal to you?
I think that goes way back. When I was younger, I was in maybe a freshman in high school. I started reading Chandler. And I was younger than that the first time I saw a noir film, Double Indemnity. And it was just a really... It was so, to me, it was so rich. You know, when you're a kid and you watch Disney movies and you see these sort of happy movies and they're all nice and they're what children should be watching. But one day you stumble on something that's black and white and people, I remember the end scene in Double Indemnity when Fred McMurray is talking with Barbara Stanwyck and she's going on about how she loves him. And he says, I'm not buying it, baby. And then he shoots her. And it's just, you know, to me, it was like taking drugs for the first time. It just took you to a place that you had never been before, and I fell in love with that. And then when you read Chandler, and he's talking about Los Angeles, and I'd never been at the time, but this place that is just so dark and strange, and you know that he has this love-hate relationship with it, it's really powerful. It certainly was powerful for me, at least. And I thought it was just, instead of looking at the world and accepting everything that you see, noir is certainly cynical, and it was interesting to me that these people could not accept everything they see and can see it for being harsh and dark and hard, but at the same time find these little gems that to me meant a little bit more because they were gems in a very dark place. It's like digging up diamonds. The rocks around you are all dark and dirty, but there's that one thing that glitters, and it glitters a little more brightly because it does shine in the darkness.
My guest is John Ridley. His new novel is called Love is a Racket. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic, screenwriter, and novelist John Ridley. Now, you write a comic version of noir. For example, in Stray Dogs, your novel that was adapted into the movie U-Turn, it's really a comic twist on the loner who comes to a new town and is set up in some kind of blackmail or murder plot. In your novel, every step he takes, he meets another crazy, sinister character who's abusing him or setting him up. There's always a woman who's sitting down next to him, and next minute he's beaten up by her boyfriend who's just walked in the door and assuming right. that they're having an affair, which of course they're not.
Right.
How did you come up with the premise for that?
Well, I think, you know, I certainly love noir, but I think if you just go in and you take sort of a straight-ahead approach, you're really sort of setting yourself up. I mean, people have done it and done it so well. How are you going to compete with Chandler or Thompson or Kane, people like this? You really can't. And for me, because I think I was a stand-up comedian, I had written sitcoms, and I had a funny bone. I didn't want it to be a straight out-and-out comedy, but I certainly wanted to have a lighter touch and sort of a dark comic touch. And also, I think with Stray Dogs, as a guy who, as a comedian, had been on the road and traveled to a lot of small towns and had a lot of sort of odd incidents, I definitely wanted to draw from a semi-real place. These are all much more hyperbolic than anything that ever happened to me. But that feeling, and I think we've all had that feeling, maybe in a small sense or a large sense, but you get trapped at an airport and you can't get out of it. There's a snowstorm and all the shops are closed and you just feel like the world is closing in on you. Or you're somewhere and your car breaks down and you just want to get out of that town. And I just wanted to take that feeling and put kind of a comic spin on it so that people could enjoy it without being beaten up every minute by a very morose tale. Noir, I think, is hard for a lot of people to take because it is tough. And it is, you know, it's a downer. Everybody's down. And this story you can read and you can have a little bit of fun with it. I always say, you know, it's fun, and it's funny. And then the bodies start adding up at the end.
There's a scene I want to play from U-Turn. And this is a scene where, you know, Sean Penn, the stranger in the small town, is just going from one mishap to another, from one, like, abusive stranger to another.
Right.
And now he's in a diner. And, of course, they don't have what he wants to order. And he's sitting down just kind of being astonished at how bad his luck is. Then Claire Danes comes over and sits down next to him and starts flirting with him.
Right.
Then her boyfriend, played by Joaquin Phoenix, walks in the door. Phoenix assumes that Sean Penn is trying to make it with his girlfriend, Claire Danes, and here's what happens.
No. Now, I'm seeing, but I'm not believing. No.
Mister, what do you think you're doing, my girl?
And here I asked you a question.
Toby, we wasn't doing nothing.
Shut
we was
mouth,
just
girl.
Talking.
Get back over to our table. Mister, don't make me ask you again. What do you think you're doing with my girl?
I wasn't doing anything.
Well, that's not the way it looked to me. It looked to me like you were trying to make time with her.
Make time with her? Is everybody in this town on drugs?
Honest, Toby, I just asked him for a quarter for the
girl, drink. Shut your mouth. Look here, mister. You and me, we got a little man's business to take care of. And no, I ain't never taking no drugs.
Well, maybe you should. Now, look, I wasn't trying to make time with you, girl. Okay?
Stop calling me that.
You want to fight over her?
You know, I don't think you know who I am. The name's Toby N. Tucker. People around here call me TNT. You know why?
They're not very imaginative.
Because I'm just like Dynamite Boy, and when I go off, somebody gets hurt.
Fine. I was trying to make time with your girl, you're right. And now I'm terrified, and I've learned my lesson, and you can go away.
Jesus Christ. Stand up. Stand up, mister, or I'll beat you where you sit.
That's a funny scene. And I think I particularly like The part where Phoenix describes why people call him TNT, and Sean Penn points out what a cliche this is. And that's something that kind of comes up in your fiction, where somebody says something and the main character realizes this is a real cliche. And I figure that's what you're up against a lot as a writer. A lot of people say things to you, and you're thinking, "Boy, that's really a cliche."
You're right. I mean, I think there are those times when you're writing something, and I certainly don't go into it to write like, "Okay, I'm going to do this and claim it, and therefore get away with it." But there's so many times when you write something. For example, with Love Is a Racket, I got one review. Where they compared the entire book to The Grifters by Jim Thompson, because both the lead character in this story and the lead character in The Grifters play the short con. And out of everything that happens in both books, it boils down this comparison that they're both con people and therefore they dismissed Love as a Racket. So you're always up against people's perception of what you're doing and how you're playing things out. And there are a couple of times where I certainly am writing something and I'm thinking, okay, you know, no matter what I do with this, somebody's going to look at it and think this. So, you know what, let me think it for them and therefore mitigate what they're going to say. So I don't think you can spend your life second guessing your critics and things like that. But I think no matter what you do, if somebody is not going to like what you do, they're going to find a reason to not like it. So all you can do is go out and have a little bit of fun with it. It's interesting about that scene. I really love that scene in the book, and I also like the way it turned out in a movie. And that scene actually really happened to me once when I was
really?
At a club in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I was at a bar. I was hanging out, and this girl comes up to me and just starts putting on the full press. And, you know, you're a young guy, and you're alone at a bar in the middle of nowhere, you're just impressed as heck. And I mean, I was having a great time with her, and I left the bar. And the bartender had been serving me drinks that whole time that I was sitting there. He came out, and he's a nice guy, and I've been talking to him, too. He just came over to me and goes, "Oh, hey, by the way, that girl you were flirting with all night, that was my girlfriend." And she apparently went into bars and did that, went into this bar and did that a lot with guys in front of him just to piss this guy off. And I was very fortunate. He was a nice guy and he was used to it and wasn't trying to beat the heck out of me. But that was something that really stuck with me, and that's the reason I put it in the book.
Well, I have one more question for you, and this is a test of your ethics.
Yeah.
You, you had to learn a lot of short cons in order to put them in your novel, because your character is a con man. Did you practice any of them to test them out before writing them?
I did not practice the short con. I will tell you something that I hope I cannot be prosecuted for. And there was something I used to do because I don't know why I did it really, but I used to, and this was when I was making really good money too. I used to go into we have big supermarkets out here. I don't want to say which one it was, but they're open 24 hours. And so you go in very, very late, and it's nobody's there, and people are stocking, and nobody's paying attention. I used to steal magazines. I would always steal one magazine out of the store just because I wanted to do it. I wanted to get away with it. I wanted that feeling of stealing something. I'll tell you the last time it happened. I was stealing a magazine out of the store, and I was standing in line. And I had it tucked under my jacket. And I was holding it there with one hand. Waiting for a checkout person because there was nobody there because it was so late. These two LAPD cops come up behind me and are standing in line. And so I'm standing there with this magazine that clearly I'm lifting. And at first I thought they were coming straight to bust me. Then they're standing there to buy something. And I'm waiting for a checkout person. And you have this incredibly long minute with these cops that are there that could easily bust you. And it was great for me because I would certainly never commit a large crime, but I think it's very hard to write about these things if you don't have this moment where you feel what it's like to be hunted or wanted by the police. And it was a great experience, one, because it certainly got me over that desire to lift things for whatever reason, but two, just to be in that place where I put my characters and to be able to really experience that emotion. So I do have that. I do have that. So I fess up to it, and I will probably be getting a knock on the door later in the day.
I'm making a few phone calls as soon as I'm done.
I know. Well, I can say it was 7 years ago, so I can't be prosecuted for it. So it's an admission.
Where do you think this compulsion came from to steal magazines?
I think it's cheap to write about something that you don't have any you don't have any relation to, and to write about crime and to write about bad things. I don't ever want to go out and commit a real crime. I don't want to commit a felony. I don't want to go to jail.
So you think you were doing this as a writer?
I think I was doing it as a writer, but not necessarily as a writing exercise, but as someone who's into noir and into the dark side. And I had a friend who kept telling me, he says, man, one day you're going to get caught, and no one's going to have any sympathy for you because you write for television, and it's going to be the most embarrassing thing in the world. Television writer gets nabbed stealing a $2 magazine, you know? I mean, what do you say? It's not like, hey, I had to feed my family or I don't have a job or anything like that. But I had to know, I had to have that feeling of getting away with something. And it was, I think, perfect that the police showed up right behind me and to have to sit there and sweat it out for a second. And again, I don't ever want to sweat out, you know, are the police going to catch me for killing somebody or robbing jewels? But to be able to transpose my feelings into my characters, it's, you know, you've got to make that leap just a little bit, but it's certainly much smaller now than just, okay, I'm sitting in my apartment or my house and I'm making it up. So it was a great experiment. It was a terrific experiment. I'm completely over it. I don't recommend it, and I'm not advocating a life of crime to anybody under any circumstances. But, you know, the old adage, you got to write about what you know. Well, now I know, so I can write about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John Ridley's new novel is called Love is a Racket. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.